So thank you all for coming. You'll have to bear with me. I'm getting over some severe bronchitis, so it's a little difficult for me to speak very clearly. I'm Michael Martinez. I used to write extensively about Tolkien and Middle-earth for a website called Sweet 101. I did that for several years and was involved in online Tolkien fandom. Also did some stuff associated with the movies that Peter Jackson put out. I wrote three books. One was called Visualizing Middle-earth, which I've brought copies here for people in MerpCon. If you would like me to sign it, I ask that you give Hawk a donation to help underwrite the costs of the conference. My most popular book is an e-book called Parma and Dorian, Essays on Middle-earth. And it was actually the first collection of essays that I wrote and published about Tolkien. There have been over a million downloads. I don't know exactly how many. People have stopped counting through the years, but it's probably what most people who have heard of me have read, or are more likely to have read. And my last book was called Understanding Middle-earth, Essays on Middle-earth. It's not to be confused with another Understanding Middle-earth, Tolkien's Sanctifying Myth. So, Hawk asked me to come out here and talk a little bit. We talked very briefly not too long ago, and I came away with the impression that he wanted me to say something about hobbits and or dwarves. So while recuperating from bronchitis, I decided to investigate or explore some characteristics of Tolkien's dwarves that only get occasional mention. He compared them to the Hebrews, and when he made that comparison, he was thinking of the Hebrews of history, not necessarily today's Jewish community. He didn't distinguish between them, but he was thinking more in terms of the diaspora that the Hebrews went through one or two or three times during their history. And he compared the dwarven wanderings across Middle-earth to that. So what I wanted to start out with was there are three groups or races that Tolkien could have used as sources for inspiration for his wandering folk tales. The first one, of course, is the Hebrews. The second one are the Goths. The Goths were driven out of their lands in the 4th century by the Huns. Some Goths did stay behind and take service with the Huns. Other Goths moved into the Roman Empire and spent a couple of generations trying to work out something with the Romans before they were either killed off or enslaved or driven out of the empire. A third group of people, if I recall correctly, are believed to have left India sometime around 1000 AD, maybe 1100 AD. And they've scattered throughout the world, but they're most closely associated with Europe now. They call themselves Romani or Romani, and we know them as Gypsies. And they have never been able to find a national homeland. They've been subjected to persecution. They've been treated as outcasts by most societies. And very sadly, just a couple of weeks ago, two young girls, I think one was 12 and one was 13, drowned on just off of a beach in Italy. And they were both from Romani families. I hope I say that close to correct. Their bodies were recovered by lifeguards, and they were laid out on the beach waiting for authorities to come take them. And all of the people on the beach just sat around and went about their business and apparently expressed no grief or concern over the tragedy that had befallen these two young girls. It was a scandal in Italy. Even the Pope said something to reprimand people about their apparent apathy towards the death of those two girls. But that's an example of just how deeply entrenched hostility, or if not hostility, I guess cultural barriers can become between peoples when you have strangers, cultural or ethnic strangers from other lands living inside your own areas. People do tend to set up different standards. And Tolkien was very much aware of this, very conscious of it. He did actually project this kind of cultural disparity into several aspects of his stories. There are a number of wandering peoples, wandering folks who were driven out of their homes. One example would be the men of Brethel in the first age, the folk of Haleth. They were the second house of the Edain to enter Beleriand. They originally settled in eastern Beleriand in the lands of the Noldoran prince Caranthir. And they lived there for a couple of generations, and then orcs came down and attacked them and killed off most of the people. And the survivors decided that they didn't want to stay there. They gathered together, they crossed over the river Gelion and went to settle briefly with other men, but they didn't find a home there. So they wandered around through dangerous lands and eventually ended up on the far side of the kingdom of Doriath, which was King Thingol's realm. And they took possession of a forest there that technically was under Thingol's authority, but he wasn't really possessing it. And according to the Silmarillion, when they settled there, he was a little offended. So his nephew, Finrod, King Finrod of Nargothrond, negotiated an arrangement, which worked out pretty much for Thingol's benefit, but they didn't receive a warm welcome, let's just say that. So there were outcasts that actually came from that community. And those outcasts ended up, some of them ended up becoming outlaws who served in the outlaw band that Turin, son of Hurin, took leadership of. So Tolkien just has these wanderings going on, and they just keep repeating over and over again.
And it wasn't just the dwarves who were driven from their homes. But the dwarves started out as wanderers. If you're familiar with the myth that Tolkien wrote for the creation of the dwarves, supposedly the smith of the Valar, Aue, was impatient for the arrival of the children of God to wake up on Earth, so he created his own children, the dwarves. And when God confronted him over what he did, he offered to destroy them and just back off from what he was doing. Because he was willing to make that sacrifice, God said, well, I'll adopt your children, but they won't wake up before my children, but I'll let them flourish for a while. And so Aue took the dwarves. There were six pairs, male and female, and one extra male, and he laid them in separate caves, and they all woke up, and he eventually, according to unpublished texts that were published in, I'm going to say the last volume of the history of Middle-earth, don't hold me to that. At any rate, somewhere along the way, Christopher Tolkien revealed that the dwarves all eventually came together at Mount Gundabad, which, if you've read The Hobbit, you're familiar that the goblins had control of Mount Gundabad at the end of the Third Age, and there was a lot of enmity and strife between hobbits and dwarves, and that was one of the reasons why, supposedly. So the dwarves wandered, got together, flourished, increased their numbers, and then went off and settled cities back where their ancestors had woken up. There were two cities in the mountain, the Blue Mountains, on the edge of Beleriand that they founded, and those were Nogrod and Belagost, both of which were destroyed or damaged in the various wars and aftermath of Beleriand. It's not clear from Tolkien's writings how many of those dwarves actually left the Blue Mountains. There were always some dwarves who stayed there. I had the impression that because of the war with the elves that they fought over cursed treasure, the dwarves of Nogrod were almost wiped out, whereas the dwarves of Belagost probably composed most of the dwarves who eventually migrated to Moria and joined Durin's folk there. So another wandering folk tradition that you find in Tolkien is the tradition about the wandering companies of elves. And these started out as, well, I guess the first group would have been the Eldar themselves, the original three groups of elves who agreed to undertake the great journey and go west and migrate over the sea to live with the Valar. And not all of them finished that trip. Some of them, like, turned off here and some of them turned off there, and nobody quite knew what to make of them. Some of them eventually found their way into Beleriand. They were called they came from the group called the Nandor, and they became the Green Elves of Osiriant. And one of the interesting things I think about the green elves of Osiriand is that they tend to be the archetype that most people, particularly in the role-playing community, associate with all of Tolkien's elves. Tolkien described different cultural priorities for each elven group. Some of them were shipmakers, some of them were miners and technologists, and some of them were very holistic. They were very natural. They didn't want to kill animals and things like that, and they tried not to damage trees too much. Those were the green elves of Osiriant. So it was a very small group of elves who were basically very nature-potent elves, and somehow, through the years, many Tolkien fans have come to the conclusion that all of Tolkien's elves lived with nature in harmony the way that the green elves did, and that's not really true. Most of the elves would cut down trees, so cut down their fair share of trees. They hunted. They are very little like the supposed nature harmony elves that a lot of people really just envision there. So I'm not really sure how that metamorphosis occurred, but you even find a big indication of this in Peter Jackson's movies. He honored that fanish perception. Most of the elves that you meet in the Lord of the Rings movies are pretty much living in harmony with nature. They don't like to really kill things if they don't have to, and they have a lot of respect for trees and the natural world. They're not really considered to be industrialized or technologists. And we had an interesting conversation a little bit earlier. It couldn't go very far, but somebody asked, as we were starting up a role-playing session here, what does an elf do for, say, 500 years if he comes into a role-playing game as a level 3 character, which, if you're not familiar with role-playing games, that's someone who doesn't have very much skill. And I was thinking about that on the way out here the other day. It occurred to me that Tolkien never really did industrialize his elves. He called the Noldor technologists, but he didn't call them industrialists. And a lot of people know that Tolkien was not very fond of industrialization. He felt that it not only harmed the landscape, it stripped the individual of their individuality. So imagine you're a Noldor and smith, and you're making your living off of mass producing, say, cups. Okay, you are the chief glass maker in a Noldoran kingdom, and you've made thousands of these glasses. Probably no one of them is going to be the same. I mean, if I were that artistic and I had that much time to work with, I think I would eventually become so bored after mastering my skill that I would make a mold for a unique glass, create the glass, and then destroy the mold. Because you've got all the time in the world, and you've got a little bit of magic to help you. So just imagine, here you are traveling through a Noldoran kingdom, you come to a glasswork shop, and you find that this guy has made all these glasses and plates and things out of glass. Would you really want to see manufactured, mass-produced, machine-stamped-out dinnerware, or would you expect to see artistic pieces, each one of them unique? So if you broke one of these glasses, it would be gone forever. That shape would be lost. I think that might be something that Tolkien would envision for his elves, because it's just a way for them to refine their art and their skill and their passion without losing interest. I think it would become boring if you spent 500 years just making glasses the same way. So you might start out making a simple blue glass, and 500 years later you've got a glowing blue glass that sings at night and dances in the morning or something. I mean, it's just refining your skill and your individuality. Individuality was a very important thing for Tolkien. And individuality, if I can bring it back to the sense of two cultures clashing, is very important to what goes on in the conflicts between the various peoples who are wandering around the landscape and the peoples who are settled there. Tolkien tried to give an identity, an ethnic identity, to each of his groups. He didn't do it all at once. He gradually added layers of complexity to his stories and to his characters and to the fictional cultures that these characters came from. So those are my thoughts on dwarves and elves. What I'm anybody like to ask me to adjust my thoughts, or do you have a question? For those of you who are just watching this, I'm seeing some eyes glazed over and some people going, wow, this guy's really like out there. You know, I've had a lot of time to think about this, you see. I've thought about this sort of stuff for years. But are there any questions at this point or anything? Or?
I just left that motorcycle.
Yeah, there's probably a motorcycle on that. It was a Noldren motorcycle. I've never heard a motorcycle that quite sounded that way. You know, can you imagine a Noldor bike gang? No two bikes would look the same. You know, they might have a club emblem or something, but they'd all have different jackets and different colors. Those would be the dwarves. A bike gang in Indonesia. I'll tell you what, I would not want to be the cop that breaks up a bike gang fight between elves and dwarves, you know? That's where the modern elves and dwarves might go, you know, as biker gangs for all we know. They're wandering around the landscape. They're not really, you know, making big kingdoms or anything. They don't really disturb most people, but a lot of people view them with distrust. Modern biker groups are in some ways outcasts or semi-outcasts from society, just like Hebrews and Goths and Gypsies have been. Do I need to... I'm fine. Okay. So, I can bring it down to Middle Earth a little bit more if y'all would like.
What kind of connection, if any, is there between the Green Elves and the Druidic cultures?
Okay, so I've been asked what kind of connection, yeah, if any, is there between the Green Elves and the Druidic cultures. I'll try to answer that a little bit, but I'll tell you what, John Ratliff would probably be better to ask him. In reading the history of The Hobbit, I noticed that he went deeper into the Celtic traditions than Douglas Anderson did in The Annotated Hobbit. I think most scholars acknowledge that there is a strong Celtic tradition or element in some of Tolkien's cultures, and the Green Elves of Osirian might actually be an expression of Tolkien's idea of what ancient Druidic peoples or groups might have been like. The Green Elves did actually try to integrate a little bit after their king was killed into Thingol's kingdom of Doriath. They were called the Guest Elves. They lived in the southeastern corner. They didn't really get along with everybody. In one layer of the Turin tradition, the elf who insults Turin supposedly comes from that group. His name was Saros. Or Saras, I'm not sure. I'm terrible at pronouncing Elvish words and names. So he was some sort of a dark elf who...
His black Irish?
What I mean is that he was dark in mood, in nature. His family apparently had become advisors to the Elven King, and he was just one of these people who had, for whatever service or years of service, had become somewhat trusted by King Thingol, who was nonetheless arrogant. He really didn't know much about men, and probably didn't trust them much. So here was a stranger in a kingdom, mistreating another stranger in a kingdom. And this motif occurs often throughout Tolkien's stories. You can find it everywhere. Even in the Shire, you have groups of hobbits distrusting other groups of hobbits because they live far away and just like treat them as a little bit offish, but because family. On the other hand, the Brandy Bucks had left the Shire. They moved across the river to found the Buckland. And people deeper in the Shire really didn't think much of the Brandy Bucks. They sort of derided them. They didn't understand why the Brandy Bucks would like use boats. And they thought that they were very strange people. Even though we know that through the Brandy Buck characters we meet, they're really no different from the rest of the hobbits. It's just a cultural division had occurred, and the mainstream Shire hobbits no longer really understood their cousins in the Buckland. This is another thing that Tolkien does in his stories, is he starts out with a core group and then he breaks it up, and he follows the evolutionary paths that these core groups take. And part of what drives that process, of course, as many people are aware, is the language development. When you take groups of people and separate them, they're going to very gradually start to use words differently and form new ways of expressing ideas. That's called idiom. And Tolkien was a philologist, someone who studied language, the way it changes over time. A philologist is not simply somebody who studies language. It's somebody who studies the growth and evolution of language. So Tolkien's stories were rooted in that sense of how things grow and evolve and branch out and spread out and create differences and distinctions. So he wasn't just doing it with his languages. He was also doing it with his clans and his cultures and things like that. And it's very closely tied. In one of his letters, he complained that a lot of artificial languages like Esperanto, which was popular about 100 years ago, aren't really living languages. Even though people were trying to speak them, they weren't trying to live through those languages. Whereas a language like English, now there are jargon words that you only hear in certain contexts. I would say 150 years ago, you could go to different parts of the United States and people would talk very differently. They had different ways of talking about the same things. And it was very close to a real dialectal difference. I think linguists disagree over how much of growth we had in terms of establishing real dialects. I know that they trace most of these regional accents and idioms back to regional differences in England. But what we've done through technology is we've learned to communicate with each other over radio, television, and now the internet. And there's been this smoothing process in terms of how everybody uses the base language. So we've brought it back together. But because there are 300 million people in this country, we have areas of specialization. So where we're getting our new dialects from is not from regions where people live, but from professions in which people work, where they develop very intricate vocabularies that are very unique and very specialized. But you can have entire conversations in some of these vocabularies that other people really don't understand. We do have one tradition, I think it's only native to North America, I could be wrong, where carnies, carnival workers, have their own language that they developed among themselves. I've met some of these carnies, and I've listened to them speak this language. I couldn't begin to speak it, but it sounds very bizarre to the untutored ear. It's like isbiz, kiz, kishishish. You know, they could be saying something like, this guy is a real jerk, you know, let's rip him off. Or they could say, I really like this person, let's give him a nice prize. They can arrange to move things around without telling people that they're doing things. So the carny language, I understand, is fairly robust. The last time I heard it was about 10 years ago. I was in a gas station, and a young man was walking out of the gas station. He turned to the cashier, and he said something in that language, and the cashier responded in normal English and said, well, tell your mother when you get home or something, and the young man left. So I turned to the man. I said, was he speaking in Carnie? And he goes, yeah. Do you know the language? I said, no. I heard it spoken 20 years ago, and that sounded very much like it. And he said, yeah, it's sort of dying out now, but his family is trying to keep it going. That family was no longer involved in the carnivals. So our carnival workers... Sorry, there was another Sindarin motorcycle there. Our carnival workers are not really outcasts, but they do represent a part of our society that's not really considered mainstream. And now there are families who have left the carnival circuit, and they're doing other things, but some of them are trying to retain their family traditions, the old carnival language, and who knows what else they do. Some of those families are very wealthy. They own a lot of land and a lot of equipment, and they're very respectable people. So that theme of outcasts wandering across the country or not just outcasts, but nomads who really don't know where they're going or don't want to settle down, is something that Tolkien really adopted strongly throughout his traditions because he saw it throughout life. Chris, you got a question?
What's your
What's my take on comparing Tolkien's elven cultures to real human cultures?
Well,
or
I know there's a big
So the question is grounded in some criticisms that have been leveled at Tolkien. Some people have said that he created an allegory, and Tolkien said he did not create an allegory, but yet he introduced all of these parallels in the way his history, his cultures progressed. And I would say that there are two reasons why he did that. First, in order to be relevant to your audience, you have to tell a story that your audience can relate to. And those of us who love history and invest our time in learning about history see these trends in populations. So Tolkien also saw those trends in populations, and he simply used that process to make his story seem familiar. The other thing is that he wasn't making an allegory, he was making a heroic fantasy. So he was trying to recreate the epic sense that you get from very old stories. There's a tradition going back to Gilgamesh up through the heroic poems that Homer and his contemporaries wrote, passing through Roman poets who also wrote epic literature, up into Middle English poets and French medieval poets. Every major culture has created these long stories about great heroes undertaking massive challenges against overwhelming odds and somehow succeeding. And Tolkien was very familiar with all the versions of poems that medieval Tolkien scholars have uncovered as being influencing him. It's called King Alexander, or Alessander. And if I recall correctly, it was composed probably in the 13th century. It's a Middle English poem that retells the story of Alexander the Great. Another story that appears to have influenced Tolkien is called The Fall of Troy, which was a Roman poem based on the epic cycle that ancient Greek poets had created. All that we have left of the epic cycle are just fragments and two poems from Homer. But the epic cycle was written over about 200 years. It was mentioned in many ancient texts, and it documented the entire story of the Trojan War. The Trojan War had a big impact on J.R.R. Tolkien's writing. He not only introduced elements of the Trojan War into his first age stories with the fall of Gondolin, but also there are echoes of it in the siege of Minas Tirith, because all these armies are brought together to destroy Minas Tirith, which is a very powerful, wealthy city that rests on a hill or a mountainside, and it's considered to be impregnable. And the only thing that Tolkien did there that was really different was that he had the Trojans win that time. So this theme of reusing old elements from older tales and other cultures that has gone on through human history was a very strong influence on Tolkien's writing. He was very experimental, and he would start a story and take it so far, and then he would stop and he would retell the story. And he might change the characters, he might change the landscapes, he might change the settings. I've learned a lot not that I'm trying to be obsequious to John Ratliff, but I've learned a lot from what I've read of his book. His research is very thorough and in-depth. He has proposed some ideas about how closely connected The Hobbit really was to Tolkien's Silmarillion mythology. Until the history of The Hobbit was published, there wasn't that much evidence in the published world to show a close connection. It's going to take me at least a year to really formulate my thoughts, but one of my early thoughts is that The Hobbit may have been one of Tolkien's experiments at taking his adult, mature Elvish mythology and simply recasting a lot of it into a children's story, and taking the elves and making them a background factor and making The Hobbit the foreground factor. So what I'm trying to say is that I think Tolkien was trying to retell a story that he had shaped over the course of about 15 years in a way that his children could enjoy it and see some of the stuff that he was trying to do without getting all caught up in all the adult meticulous details that the kids are not yet ready to enjoy and appreciate fully. So people are going to try to figure out how the landscapes that Tolkien developed for The Hobbit are geographically related to the landscapes that Tolkien created for his Elvish stories. And what it looks to me like on first pass is that Tolkien may actually simply have taken the Elvish landscape and reshaped it, renamed it, and given it different populations. And the Hobbit's lands are an alternate version of the Silmarillion's lands. So it wasn't until J.R.R. Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings that he had to create a broader landscape and give each of these earlier landscapes their own identity that worked together. He actually developed other geographical features for The Lord of the Rings that had not been hinted at in the earlier stories. So that's just one way of how Tolkien, in his own personal writing, mirrored the progression that he was trying to be a part of, where ancient writers and less ancient writers and medieval writers were reinventing the same landscapes, the same characters, the same stories. They were telling new legends that were really old legends, and in a way Tolkien was trying to do the same thing, more at a level where a philologist can see it better than the rest of us. But he experimented so often, he ended up with so much material that he could just reuse stuff endlessly. So that really gets away from the concept of dwarves, I see, I realize, but that was actually a very interesting question. Thank you.
It was actually kind of confusing to me trying to get that across. And that, now that I've thought about it a little bit more, I guess what my question is do you think in Tolkien's mind that he ever saw elves as being humans?
Yes. He said so. In at least one of his letters, he viewed them as sort of pre-fall humans who had a separate fall. That's a very spiritual question, but he basically admitted that they were biologically human, but spiritually he also saw them as human, but in a different spiritual state from the Catholic point of view, from humanity that exists, that lives here today. So they're an expression of Tolkien's ideal of what humans might have become had they not sacrificed through sin some of the gifts that God had given them. That's so, perhaps presumptuous on my part, but that's the way I see it.
So if you're comparing it to Catholic theology, does that mean that elves are equivalent with angels prior to the fall, or equivalent with humans before the snake and the apple?
If you're looking at Catholic theology, Tolkien would have seen the elves as humans before the snake in the Garden of Eden. So I don't remember all the details. He didn't say very much on the subject, but he did say that they were pretty much intended to be more or less like us, humans, but who took a different branch, spiritually, idealistically. These questions are kind of hard to answer, though, because of an issue about what is considered canonical. I never say that word right, but what is the authoritative vision that Tolkien was publishing? And nobody can answer the question, because he kept reinventing things, not only through unpublished works, but also through published works. He revised the published books, and he brought out new books that disagreed with the older books, and then his son Christopher brought out all this stuff. And there's a word that modern scholars, Tolkien scholars, have taken from Tolkien's letters that they're applying in a somewhat different way from what Tolkien does. And that word is called legendarium. In other words, Tolkien referred to a legendarium when he was talking to people about these ideas that he was trying to find a final form for. And modern scholars have to deal with all the complexities and all the differences between the various layers and things like that. So when you read Tolkien literature today and you see people talking about the legendarium, they're talking about everything. All the different layers, all the different experimental paths, and all the contradictions all taken together. Whereas in Tolkien's mind, when you look at his letters and just forget what the rest of us have said, it's a much simpler context. And Christopher Tolkien tried to explain this in one of his books. His father had a vision of what the whole set of stories should be. And that vision did grow as he added new things. So when the hobbits came along and Middle-earth formed, that was different from the earlier version of the legendarium. But Tolkien was never able to really put it all down the way he wanted to share it.
But so it seems completely in keeping with his philology background and the evolution of things and that literary palimpsest.
That is
90% of writing is rewriting.
I think Tolkien was very comfortable with the idea of constantly evolving, but he also just wanted to tell a really great story that people would appreciate. And he could just never get it right enough. He always wanted to fix it. So when here we are years later trying to talk about J.R.R. Tolkien and Middle-earth, you've got one person over here talking about this vision of Middle-earth, and another person over here talking about this vision of Middle-earth. They're not the same visions, okay? And they're not Tolkien's visions, they're our visions. We can't... Well, I'm hoping Ghost Hunters will bring up Tolkien's spirit and get some questions answered, because John didn't answer all the questions that I was hoping he was able to answer in his research. There are some things we'll just never really know. So, are there any other questions? Okay, I see some of the younger members of the audience are maybe a little bit bemused by what I'm talking about. Would you guys like to ask some questions at all or anything? This was supposed to be about dwarves, but it evolved. You got a question?
Because I haven't studied a lot of history about Middle-earth, and I haven't read Silmarillion. I listened to the audio recording in 5 minutes, I turned it off. Actually, I shouldn't
have. So the Silmarillion, overwhelmed you quickly?
Yeah, it's starting to get the radio, so I wasn't even there. But again, it's a clear show. Anyway, about dwarves.
Dwarves are based on humans, okay? There's not that close a connection between the dwarves and the Hebrew culture in that respect, but the dwarves represent what's called an archetype, kind of human grouping of professions. They were tradesmen, and they were craftsmen, and they were warriors. And these are all what we would call aggressive people, okay? Tradesmen, merchants, they wanted to accumulate wealth. They want to become leaders of society, and they want to have the power, the individual power, to decide for themselves what they're going to do. And in the creation myth of the dwarves, one of the strengths that Ale gave them was what Tolkien called an indomitable will. And the reason why he did this was there was this Dark Lord who was ruling most of Middle-earth, and he was enslaving people. And Morgoth, yeah. So one of the things that Morgoth did was he would mentally just beat you down and mentally enslave you. And Al-Ai didn't want that to happen with the dwarves. So the dwarves became very stubborn, and that stubbornness helped them withstand the evil domination. But when that opposing force was removed and Morgoth was defeated, the dwarves were still stubborn. So that stubbornness evolved into, you know, different things.
So does that imply that the dwarves would be the mafia of Middle-earth?
No, I wouldn't call the dwarves the mafia of Middle-earth. A biker gang might be a little more appropriate. But, I mean, they were proud. They were somewhat arrogant. They stood off. At least one group of them stopped sharing their language with non-dwarves. There were things about the dwarven culture that were, in some ways, like the carnival culture. They were very secretive, but they also interacted with people. They would travel if they needed to. They engaged in commerce, business, did business with people. But they were very skilled at what they did, and other people couldn't really do that. Of course, they were not entertainers, which is what carnival carnies do. They're entertainers. But the dwarves had this insular cultural identity that hardened over time. And they never lost those native strengths that they were given, but the purpose for those native strengths wasn't always needed, or wasn't always there. There were times of lengthy times of relative peace where there were no Dark Lords trying to dominate everybody's wills. So who did the dwarves have to argue with except men and elves? And of course, most people, you know, focus on the elvish arguments because Tolkien wrote more stories about conflict between elves and dwarves than between conflicts between men and dwarves. But the point is that the dwarves were basically built for conflict. And so they were very aggressive people, and they needed to be treated with respect. So when other cultures did not treat them with respect, they stood up to those cultures and pushed back. And that's what helped create some of that division there. So, and I can speak from a personal level. I can tell you that's not productive. But the dwarves were very good at getting along with people as long as they were respected. And when they weren't respected, I think that's when problems developed. That's a good question, though. Yeah, you got another?
Another question.
I'm going to tell you what somebody told me when I was first trying to start to write literature. Hobbits are a warm fuzzy. A warm fuzzy is something that the reader will attach to emotionally and become engaged with. You want the warm fuzzy to win. So he was entertaining his kids, his three sons, and he just wanted to tell stories about heroes and monsters and things like that, but he wanted his kids to appreciate, to engage emotionally with the hero. And I think what really happened was that when he created this story, he just found a character very much like himself that his sons could relate to. Because you know, he's a warm fuzzy, and that's a concept I'm not qualified to really teach.
But there's a whole book about warm fuzzies and cold fuzzies.
Yeah, I mean there are people who teach literature who could explain the whole warm fuzzy concept much better than me. But basically, I think that's what Tolkien did with The Hobbit, was he wanted something that his children would love and enjoy and want to see that Hobbit succeed and grow. And that's not talking down to kids. That's just projecting himself, his emotional rapport with his children through a character. And I think that's what why The Hobbit, this works with adults too, okay? It's not just about kids. This works with any reading audience of any reading age. When you find a character in the story that you just don't want to put the book down and you want to know what happens to that character, you've got what's called an emotional rapport or a connection with that character. And Tolkien built that in The Hobbit by projecting himself through The Hobbit. And he admitted to that in various ways throughout his life. He called himself a hobbit. And writers do this all the time. They put some part of themselves into each of their characters. So I think that's where hobbits really came from. He just needed a way to create a character that his children would love and identify with him in a way without making it think it was him. That's part of it, but I think another reason is that because the stories were told for the children, for his sons, they could identify better with a 3-foot-tall hobbit than with a 6-foot-tall man, okay? You know, Hawk's a huge guy, and if somebody were to write a story about Hawk doing all the things that he might be physically capable of doing, I'm not sure that I would, you know, really want to emulate Hawk because he's like 6 feet taller than me. So I could connect better with a character who's my height, and I think that's why hobbits were short. Chris?
So I had a couple questions. So one is,
how did the Balrog get to Moria?
Yeah, why, how did it get there? And the second question is, why did the dwarves help Arnor when Angmar...
Oh, ran. Okay. All right, so there's two questions. One is, how did the Balrog get to Moria? And the second question is, why did the dwarves not help when the kingdom of Angmar overran the kingdom of Arnor? Okay? First of all, I don't really know the answer to either question. Nobody does. I can speculate for you. And I will speculate that the Balrog, throughout its long service to Morgoth, had probably found those caverns deep under Moria. And when it saw that the battle was lost in the first age, it just took off and went into a bolt hole. And that's all it was a bolt hole. It was some place that he knew about that hadn't been developed into a fortress for Morgoth. Tolkien never really tried to provide any complexity to the Balrogs. The closest you get to a personality for the Balrogs is with Gothmog, Lord of Balrogs, and he's about as classic a cardboard henchman as you can get in any type of literature or drama. There's just no real depth to Balrogs. As far as Arnor goes, I have done a lot of speculating of Gondor, and the men of Arnor were survivors from Numenor. So the Northern Kingdom was destroyed by the servants of Sauron, and the elves helped them, and at the end, at the very end of their struggle, they were helped possibly by some dwarves from the Blue Mountains, but the powerful dwarves of the Misty Mountains did not help them. And the only thing I can suggest is that Arnor had become so... It had originally divided into three realms. The two kingdoms closest to Khazad-dûm, to Moria, had become depopulated and overrun by evil creatures. And at the end of it, the kingdom of Arthedain, or Arnor, was just a much smaller region. So there was no real communication there.
But I mean, even before that point,
There are a few passages in The Lord of the Rings and elsewhere that indicate that the dwarves interacted very much with the elves of Lothlorien and probably interacted with Elrond. How much they would have interacted with the other men besides the men of the Vales of Anduin, I don't know. Tolkien just never developed anything. I would call that more a blank page that he would have written eventually if he could have gotten to it, but he didn't. So it's a little bit after 1 o'clock. I know we got started late. Do you want me to keep going or... Anybody have any more questions? Hey, well, okay. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for your questions, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, too.